to their natural skill level, physically and mentally. You'd watch some of them in the post-Bulls era and think, "You gotta be kidding me. What happened to that guy?" Teams were signing ex-Bulls and suddenly realizing, "We paid all that money for this?" What happened was Michael. No Michael, no relentless pressure, nobody holding them accountable and demanding unyielding excellence. Some of those guys went on to have outstanding careers in other arenas, Steve Kerr and John Paxson, to name a couple. But most of the others couldn't keep themselves at the level they were at when they were playing up to Michael's expectations. But don't be fooled. A true cleaner isn't thinking about making you better for your benefit. He's happy for you if you get something out of it. But whatever he's doing, it's for his sake, not yours. His only objective is putting you where he needs you to be, so he can get the results he desires. Look at Miami's 2012 championship season. You can talk all you want about LeBron stepping up in that final game, but without Dwayne's putting him in that position, it couldn't have happened. Remember, a closer can take the winning shot, but the cleaner gets him on the team and makes sure the ball is in his hands when it needs to be there. That sums up Dwayne and LeBron completely. Just as Michael did with his teammates, the cleaner deciding what a closer will do, Dwayne knew he had to hold back all season so LeBron could step up. No question about it. That's a cleaner crafting a plan. If I do this, then he'll do that, and in the end, we win. And in Dwayne's case, it was even more genius when you remember he was playing on a severely damaged knee that limited what he could do himself. So he put everyone else in place to do it for him. Mission accomplished. You don't question the methods. You just look for the results. Dwayne was the mastermind of that team, and LeBron played the role he was sent to play. I just can't look at it any other way. Dwayne was like a father lion. LeBron was the baby lion, and the baby lion knew that whatever he did, he always had the father lion right there, just in case. And when Dad needed to step in and protect the family, he did, and the baby went right along doing whatever he was supposed to do. You take Dwayne off that team, they can't win that championship. It doesn't matter how skilled LeBron is. Without Dwayne's leadership, the 2012 Big Three Heat would have been just another team loaded with talent and no rings. But you'll never hear Dwayne say any of that or take any credit because, in his mind, that was his job. A great leader knows the best way to get people to raise their performance is to put them where they can truly excel, not just where you want them to excel. Cleaners don't block others from reaching the top with them if they're capable and ready. And as LeBron evolves as a leader and potential cleaner, eventually he can take over responsibility for putting a winning team on the floor. Few people can be exceptional at everything, so sometimes you have to experiment before you find the right result, a process that could have led to Michael's playing center in the NBA. Before the 1984 NBA draft, the Portland Trailblazers called Bob Knight, who was coaching the U.S. Olympic basketball team that summer, which included Michael, and asked his opinion on whom they should take with the second pick in the draft. Everyone knew Houston would take Hakeem Olajuwon with the first pick, but no one, including Portland, was sure whether Portland would take Sam Bowie or Michael Jordan with the second pick. "Take Jordan," said Knight. "Right," said Portland, "but we need a center." "Play him at center," Knight said. Michael could probably have done it, too. But most people don't have that option. You have to look at your teammates, your employees, and see what they can do, not what they can't. People who evaluate talent will always take the negative. "He can't do this. He can't do that." Okay, what can he do? He got this far for a reason. How did he get here? We've established what he can't do, so let's stop waiting for him to do it. Let's find out what he can do and put him in the system where he can succeed. Everyone is given some ability at birth. Not everyone finds out what that ability is. Sometimes you find it on your own, sometimes it has to be shown to you. Either way, it's there. At the same time, there are abilities you are not given. Our challenge in life is to use the abilities we have, and to compensate for the abilities we don't have. It's completely instinctive. We compensate in order to survive. Individuals with limited vision frequently have heightened hearing. People with certain disabilities discover they have extraordinary talents in other areas. Something is given, and something is taken away. I know countless athletes who are blessed with incredible physical gifts, height, skill, strength, speed, but no work ethic, or no support system, no way to use or develop or take advantage of those skills. Successful people compensate for what they don't have. Unsuccessful people make excuses, blame everyone else, and never get past the deficiencies. A true leader can see past those deficiencies, identify the abilities, and get the most out of that individual. A cooler wonders what's going to happen. A closer watches things happen. But a cleaner makes things happen. I got deep into this discussion with a client during one of those in-case-of-emergency-break-glass meetings during the playoffs. The entire time we were together, we just talked. No physical stuff. Zero. Didn't stretch him before the game. Didn't warm him up. Didn't go to the gym. Just sat around and talked. He was upset with some of his teammates, frustrated by what he believed they couldn't do. When you're so extraordinary at your craft, when your talent is so natural and your skills so elevated, it's hard to understand that not everyone is like you and can do what you do. It's not a matter of their trying more or working harder. They really just can't do it. And if it's not handled right, it will destroy your entire team or office or wherever you have elite performers surrounded by less gifted colleagues. We talked about every guy on the team, focusing on all the players' strengths instead of their weaknesses. I told him that as the leader, his job was to recognize his players' talents and put them in situations where they could use those talents. Yes, we know this guy might mentally check out, and that guy isn't going to take a shot under pressure. We know this guy can deliver during the regular season, but in the playoffs, he's going to look like the D-League player he really is. So don't put the player in a position where it will matter. Work with the strengths, and everything else you get beyond that will be a bonus. You control this. Take charge of the situation and make it work in your favor. But, I added, you also have to recognize you're so competitive that you're crushing them with your disapproval. You don't realize the impact you have on everyone else because your wiring is completely different. When you're shaking your head or yelling at them, they shut down. And I know you love these guys, so they need to feel that you're backing them, not turning against them. I'm not doing that, he said. Yes, you are. When you say something to an individual and then turn away before he can respond or make a comment back to you, you're making your point, and you're not letting him have his say. You have to see how someone reacts so you know what's coming next. Is his head down? Is he angry? Are you motivating him or doing the opposite? When you hit someone with a negative attack, it doesn't energize him. It just brings him down. You're not going to win these guys over by making them feel worthless. He got it. By the next game, he was literally meeting his teammates at half court, patting them on the ass, showing his support, and if that's what it takes, that's what you have to do. But for any leader, it's hard to resist the temptation to take over and just get things done. Kobe's job is to get 30 to 40 points per game. As soon as you tell him to start worrying about other players, getting their points, and feeling involved, you're pulling him out of his game. Obviously, It's also his job to lead the team, but his main focus can't be on how many shots the other guys are taking. Let them worry about that. Let them come up to your level. Remember, when a cleaner gives you an opportunity, be ready, because he won't ask you again if you blow it. It's easier for him to just do the job himself. And if he's going down with the ship, he's going to make sure he's the captain. A cleaner's job is to take control and determine what has to happen to get results. You have a coach telling you this, players wanting that, but if you're the guy in the middle with the responsibility and the talent, all fingers are pointing at you, win or lose. Not just in sports, but in anything. When you're the guy they hired to make things happen, those things better happen or you won't be that guy for long. You are responsible. If there's going to be a mistake, you have to be the one to make it so you can turn it around immediately and get everyone back on track. It's all on you. But as that guy, you also need to have everybody else, all the chemistry, going the same way with you. For every chief, there has to be a tribe. And at some point, you have to let everyone in the tribe experience what it's like to be the chief, so they can all see the intricacies and issues and texture of what happens at the top and recognize what's happening in the big picture rather than getting stuck in their own little scenes. And usually, as soon as you give them the entire view and tell them it's theirs to manage, every little detail and personality and weakness and strength, as soon as you give them that moment of complete power and control, most of them say, no thanks. Easier to stay where they're at. Safe and comfortable. No one knows that better than the coaches, who not only have to figure out the tribe, but manage the chiefs as well. The good ones understand the dynamic. Let your cleaners do their thing. Those who can't give up that control eventually coach themselves out of a job. A cleaner player needs a cleaner coach, because they'll understand and respect what each other has to do. Cleaners never sell each other out. They just let the other guy take care of business. Phil understood what he had to do with Michael. You respect my job, I'll respect yours. Run a couple of plays that I need you to run, and then have at it. Phil never sought relationships with his players. He just put them in situations where they could succeed, and he didn't try to make people do what they couldn't. He's not an X and O guy. He's all about total instinct and gut feel for the game. He sees personalities and measures what they can do. With Pat Riley, another cleaner, it's all about the end result. That's why he's been so successful. You have to do it his way, and if you don't, he's going to make you do it his way. For a while, there was a lot of buzz that if Eric Spoelstra didn't coach the Heat to a title, Riley would come down to the floor and take over the job himself. The players were so fearful of that, they figured they'd better get it done for Spoelstra, who was merely tough, as opposed to Riley, who is a competitive juggernaut. Easier to deal with the apprentice than the master. Doug Collins is the best X and O guy I've ever known. He sees everything three plays ahead of everyone else, and no one else realizes what's coming. Then he puts everyone in strategic situations that appear to make no sense until the entire play unfolds, and suddenly, everything materializes. His basketball mind is off the charts. But sometimes he forgets that not everyone can do that. Guys like Riley, the Van Gundys, and Tom Thibodeau in Chicago, they tell you how it is and expect you to do it their way, which can create friction with some of the big-money superstars who don't want to do it that way. You tell these guys they're having 3-hour practices, 2-hour shoot-arounds, and pretty soon the players start to mutiny. They hear about other teams having shorter practices, less work. Now, they're questioning why they have to work so hard. You can get away with that when players are younger. But a lot of the veterans and guys who've already won something don't want to deal with it. So you'd better be winning, or your players won't buy into your philosophy. Mike Krzyzewski and I have a good relationship. We spent a lot of time talking over the years. He's the best at bringing in players who he knows will work in his system. He thinks, I have this big stud here, that guy with a high basketball IQ over there, this guy with a jump shot, and he pieces them together so it all works. They're not always the most gifted athletes, but he knows exactly what will work for his team, recognizes what they can do, and puts them in situations where they can shine. That's why he's been such a great coach for the Olympic teams. He puts people where they need to be, not just where they want to be, which is a frequent challenge when you're dealing with a dozen superstars. John Calipari goes the other way. He wants the best athletes out there so he doesn't have to mastermind anything. A different way of achieving the same result, winning, but relying more on the player's ability to excel without a lot of coaching or teaching. But regardless of how you build that team, any team, in sports or business or any endeavor, no matter how you snap the pieces into place, you need that one guy who never needs a fire lit under him, who commands respect and fear and attention, and demands that others bring the same excellence to their performance that he demands of himself. He doesn't have to be the most skilled or gifted guy on the team, but he establishes an example that everyone else can follow. The only way you can light other people on fire is to be lit yourself from the inside. Professional, cool, focused. If you had a bad night, and you can't show up the next day ready to go, or you can't show up at all, that doesn't affect just you, it affects everyone around you. A professional doesn't let other people down just because of personal issues. If you need to show up, you show up. You might detest every individual in the room, but if your presence makes them all feel better, if it pulls the team together, if it results in better performances, then you've helped yourself to get one step closer to your own goal. That's how you get others to come up to your level. Show them where it is, and set the example that allows them to get there. When you're a cleaner, you make decisions, not suggestions. You know the answer, while everyone else is still asking questions. Three things you will never hear me talk about in a good way. Inner drive, passion, and whether the glass is half full or half empty. You know what they all have in common? They all translate into, I thought about it and did nothing. What the hell is inner drive? Inner drive is nothing more than thought without action, internal wanderings that never hit the pavement to go anywhere. Completely worthless until those thoughts become external and convert to action. What good is the drive on the inside? Where are the results? People who preach inner drive are dreamers with a lot of ideas and a lot of talk, and zero production. They tell you everything they're going to do, and then they do nothing. That's inner drive. Let's move on. Passion. A strong feeling or emotion for something or someone. Very nice. Now what? Are you just feeling it, or are you going to do something about it? I love hearing motivational speakers tell people to follow your passion. Follow it? How about work at it? Excel at it? Demand to be the best at it? Follow it? Yeah. But my favorite, the timeless debate over whether some invisible glass is half full or half empty. This is a concept invented by someone suffering from the complete inability to make decisions. Half full or half empty? You have something in the glass, or you don't. If you like what's there, add more. If you don't, pour it out and start over. Otherwise, you're just staring at this non-existent glass thinking, damn, there's no way to decide. Bullshit. Of course there's a way to decide, You just don't want to commit to a decision. As soon as someone starts with the half-full, half-empty analysis, you know you're in for a long debate about nothing, with someone who can't or won't make a choice. To me, it's the equivalent of a guy standing in the middle of a busy intersection crying, "I don't know," while everyone around him screams, "Get out of the street!" Trust yourself. Decide. Every minute, every hour, every day that you sit around trying to figure out what to do, someone else is already doing it. While you're trying to choose whether to go left or right, this way or that way, someone else is already there. While you're paralyzed from overthinking and overanalyzing your next move, someone else went with his gut and beat you to it. Make a choice, or a choice will be made for you. Most people don't want to make decisions. They make suggestions, and they wait to see what everyone else thinks so they can say, "It was just a suggestion." They know the right answer, but can't act because if something goes wrong, they'll have to take responsibility and then they can't blame anyone else. Meanwhile, someone else is going to make a decision, and when it works, he's getting all the credit. And maybe the choice he made isn't one that works for anyone but him, but since no one else took charge, too bad for everyone else. A cleaner makes decisions because there's no chance in the world he's going to let anyone else make a decision for him. He may ask your opinion and add it to everything else he knows, but he's not going to do what anyone else tells him. He's still going to follow his own instincts. And once he decides, it's set in stone. He doesn't care what anyone else thinks of his choice, and he's going to live with the outcome. He decides, and then he acts. I'll give credit to the Coolers for this. They have the flexibility and willingness to rethink their decisions and change directions if you give them a reason. A cleaner will just tell you to fuck off. You can waste a lifetime sitting around overthinking possible ways to look at something. On one hand, but on the other hand, and then on this hand. Stop it. You only have two hands, and that's already too many. One guy is telling you, "Think positive," while someone else is saying, "I don't mean to be negative, but..." I don't believe in thinking positive or thinking negative. Plenty of experts have made a lot of money taking a stand on this. Good for them. But keep them away from my players. The positive thinkers want you to only visualize your success. The negative thinkers want you to focus on everything that could go wrong. Well, visualizing anything doesn't make it a reality, and overthinking imaginary problems just generates fear and anxiety. I want you armed with reflexes and instinct, not Xanax. You'll never hear me say, "We have a problem." We might have a situation that needs to be addressed, or an issue we have to resolve, but never a problem. Why automatically cast something as a negative? Instincts don't recognize positive or negative. There's only a situation, your response, and an outcome. If you're ready for anything, you're not thinking about whether it's a good situation or a bad situation. You're looking at the whole picture. And if you are thinking about it, you're out of the zone, distracted, and wasting energy and emotion, instead of focusing only on what you have to do. Thinking doesn't achieve outcomes. Only action does. Prepare yourself with everything you'll need to succeed, then act. You don't need 100 people to back you up and be your safety net. Your preparation and your instincts are your safety net. You suddenly get a great idea. Something completely comes alive in your mind. You mention it to a couple of people, and they stare at you blankly. Suddenly, you lose all your enthusiasm. Why? It's still the same idea you loved a few hours ago. What happened? Stop thinking. After that first initial thought, that first instantaneous gut reaction, why give in to the weakness of second-guessing and doubt and analysis that inevitably follow. Are you listening to others or to your own instincts? Are you taking advice from people who know what they're talking about, or those who only see failure? As soon as you allow yourself to start overthinking your decisions, you start saying things like, "I'll sleep on it," or "let's put it on the back burner," or any one of the stupid cliches that mean, "I don't trust myself to make a decision." Back burner? The back burner is for cooling things. You've just cooled a hot idea, and then you'll forget about it altogether and quit, never knowing how close you might have been to success. Speaking of cliches, here's another tribute to indecision and apathy. Good things come to those who wait. No, good things come to those who work. I understand the value of not rushing into things. You want to be quick, not careless. But you still have to work toward a result, not just sit back and wait for something to happen. You can't wait. The decision you don't make on Monday will still be waiting for you on Tuesday. And by then, two new decisions will have to be dealt with, and if you still don't make those decisions, you'll have three more on Wednesday. Pretty soon, you're so overwhelmed by everything you still haven't dealt with that you become completely paralyzed and can't do anything. Meanwhile, as you sit back doing nothing, because you're afraid to make a mistake, someone else is out there making all kinds of mistakes, learning from them, and getting to where you wanted to be, and probably laughing at your weakness. And when you do finally force yourself to make a decision, what do you choose? Almost always you go back to your first reaction, the first thing you thought of when the whole process began. You already knew. Why didn't you trust yourself the first time? You can't rely on others to jump up and make your dreams happen. They have their own dreams. They're not worrying about yours. People might be willing to help if they can, but ultimately it's on you. Get the best people around you, know your strengths and weaknesses, and trust others to do what they do best. But in the end, it's still your responsibility. Make a plan and execute. What's your plan? Everything starts with a simple thought. Every idea, every invention, every plan, every creation, it started with a thought. But to bring the thought to life, you have to put a plan together. Starting a workout, training for a sport, launching a business. You can just think about it, or you can create the plan that will get you there. Be realistic. How much time do you have? How much time will you commit? Is it going to be a priority in your schedule, or are you going to fit it in around your other commitments? Make a plan that truly reflects your goals and interests, and you'll be more likely to execute. Why pretend you're going to work out every single day when you know you're only going to do it 3 times a week? You make a choice and stand by it. Most people can't do that. They're content to wing it or see what happens. Come on. You already know what's going to happen if you go into it that way. Whatever you start is going to fall apart. But that's what most people do. They test the waters before jumping in. Why? Unless you suspect those waters are churning with crocodiles, what's the worst thing that can happen if you take the plunge? You get wet. A cleaner thinks, "No problem, I'll swim." Most people just stand at the edge, shivering and looking for a towel. Oh, you can't swim? Fine, then tell me what you can do. Why stand at the water's edge feeling sorry for yourself? Go a different way, excel in another area, while everyone else is just competing for space in the same pool. You don't become unstoppable by following the crowd. You get there by doing something better than anyone else can do it, and proving every day why you're the best at what you do. You must know someone like this. He can do everything. This week he's a blogger and a songwriter and a motivator. Last week he was teaching tennis 2 nights a week and working as a sushi chef. And on the weekends he's rebuilding a 1955 Maserati. You listen to him and feel as if you've never done a thing in your life, until you listen more closely and discover that, like a lot of people, this is someone dabbling in a lot of things and succeeding at none. I listen to those people and think, as far as I can tell, the only thing you're good at is keeping busy. I want to hear someone say, I do this. Ask Kobe what he does, and he says, I give out numbers.
Numbers?
Yep, I gave them 81. I gave them a triple-double. I gave those guys 61. People love to comment on how he doesn't pass enough, but his job is to score points and give out those numbers, and that's what he does. I'll tell a player, in order for you to reach your highest ability, this is going to be your number one focus. I want to make you excellent at this one thing. You can be average and above average at other things, but when people talk about someone who can do this, you're going to be the first name on the list. Otherwise, most people want to show they can do everything, which ultimately detracts from their real abilities. If you're not a three-point shooter, don't take those shots. If you're not a home run hitter, if you're the guy who's supposed to get on base and steal, do that. People get paid a fortune for being the expert at one thing, so that any time others need that one thing done, you're the only one they're calling. Years ago, I went with Michael to an FBI training facility where there is a practice range for the most elite sharpshooters in the world. There's one guy out there, alone, practicing his craft, over and over. The target is 400 yards away, 4 football fields. He has to get in his truck, drive to the target, set it up, and drive back to where we're standing. He gets his gun with the scope, takes aim, one shot, boom. We didn't even hear it go. Then we get in the truck with him and drive back to the target. Hit it. Dead fucking center. We would have been impressed if he'd hit the target anywhere. 400 yards. Dead center. Michael asked him how many people use that target range. He said, just me. So unless he had visitors like us, which didn't happen too often, he was alone working on this one shot. Over and over. So when people in the military need someone who can hit that kind of target, they call him. No one knows what this guy does every day to be this good. People just know he can deliver results. Figure out what you do. Then do it. And do it better than anyone else. And then let everything else you do build around that. Stay with what you know. Being great at one thing doesn't mean you can also run a restaurant, or a car dealership, or a line of sportswear. Bill Gates is not going to launch a line of sportswear. Most likely, neither should you. No matter how many years I'm in this business, I still shake my head at pro athletes who can't make the decision to commit themselves to excellence. This is your body, your livelihood. You only get a few years to ride this wave. Are you going to ride it, or lie on the beach whining that the water's too cold? One of the hardest decisions for an athlete is to determine how much fatigue and pain he can endure, and how far he can push himself. Everyone plays with pain. There's always something going on physically. The question is, how do you keep that from affecting your mentality? If you know you're going to have constant pain, can you get comfortable being uncomfortable? When some guys get injured and the doctor tells them they can't work out, they're fine with that. It's a relief, and they don't miss it. When a cleaner gets injured, he's going to find a way to work out or go crazy trying. You have to make a choice. You can listen to the doctor and have a safer, longer recovery, or you can take the shorter route, a quick fix, maybe not long-term quality, but you'll be able to play. Depends how badly you want it. If a cleaner was put in a situation where he had to remove a body part to survive, he wouldn't think twice about it. He'd figure out a way to adapt without it. Yeah, it's a finger. I can go without it. Lose a finger or lose a season? He's losing the finger. Kobe has a finger that moves in all kinds of ways a finger isn't supposed to move. A normal person would have it surgically repaired. But what's the advantage to him, other than he won't be able to bend his finger all the way around backward? Surgery will cost him 9 months of basketball. Is that worth it? Cleaners have a high tolerance for physical and mental pain. It's another great challenge to see how much they can take, what they can endure, how well they can play when they're not healthy. Michael's legendary flu game during the 1997 NBA Finals. Kobe's famed flu game during the 2012 season. You have to beware of a cleaner when he's physically sick because his body has totally challenged him to see what he's capable of. And because he's not as physically strong, he'll find another way to beat you, usually by turning up his mental game. Sickness, physical or mental, is one of the best ways to put a person in the zone. His survival instincts kick in and give him an extra gear for fighting back from a weakened state. About Michael's famous flu. I think most people recognize by now that he probably didn't actually have the flu that night in Utah. More likely it was food poisoning. Shortly before becoming ill, he had ordered in a late-night dinner from the only place we could find open in Park City, and when six guys showed up to deliver it, I felt something was wrong. Soon after, he was curled up on the floor, miserable and shaking, and sicker than I had ever seen him. Yet he had the grit and determination to play the next night, scoring 38 in what would become one of the defining games of his entire career. "Probably the most difficult thing I've ever done," he said later. Amazing what someone can do when everything is on the line. Some decisions can be life-altering. Should you retire? Have the surgery? Give up your dream? Some decisions are less challenging. After every game, I used to ask Michael one question. 5, 6, or 7? As in, what time are we hitting the gym tomorrow morning? And he'd snap back a time, and that was it. Especially after a loss, when there wasn't a whole lot else to say. No discussion, no debate, no lame attempt to convince me he needed the morning off. You good? I'm good. See you in the morning. And the next morning, at whatever time he decided, he'd awaken to find me standing outside his door. No matter what had happened the night before, good game, bad game, soreness, fatigue, he was up working out every morning while most of the other guys slept. Interesting how the guy with the most talent and success spent more time working out than anyone else. Kobe is the same. He's insatiable in his desire to work. Some days we'll go back to the gym twice a day and once more at night, trying different things, working on certain issues, always looking for that extra edge. At his level of excellence, there's no room for error, and no one in the game today works harder or invests more time in his body and surrounds himself with the right people to keep it in peak condition. But it's still not easy, and Kobe makes that decision every day to do the work. Again, the most talented guy working harder than anyone else. It's a choice. Each of Kobe's workouts takes around 90 minutes, and a half hour of that is spent just working on his wrists, fingers, ankles, all the details. That's how the best get better. They sweat the details. And every workout, at some point, he'll glare at me and ask, "What we got left?" Because let's face it, the work is hard and tedious, and sometimes that hoop looks as if it's 10,000 feet in the air, and you're trying to reach it wearing lead boots. But he does the work because if he can't put that ball in the hoop, everything else goes away. That's a choice. It all comes back to this. No matter what you do in life, are you willing to make the decision to succeed? Are you going to stand by that decision or quit when it gets hard? Will you choose to keep working when everyone else tells you to quit? Pain comes in all sorts of disguises: physical, mental, emotional. Do you need to be pain-free? Or can you push past it and stand by your commitment and decision to go further? It's your choice. The outcome is on you. When you're a cleaner, you don't have to love the work, but you're addicted to the results. A cooler makes you wish you paid him less. A closer asks how much and then decides how hard he'll work. A cleaner doesn't think about the money. He just does the work and knows you'll be grateful for the privilege of paying him. Finally, the big day. Perfect knot in your $200 tie. Mom has a new dress. The whole family is by your side. Someone suddenly whispers in your ear, "This is it." The commissioner is at the podium. "The 11th pick." You don't hear anything else. The first person to hug you is your agent. Congratulations. Today is the beginning of the end of your career. Did you exhale? Did you think, "I'm finally here, set for life"? Or did you think, "I have a lot of work to do"? Most guys on the day they're drafted go out to celebrate. Kobe went to the gym to practice. Making it to the top is not the same as making it at the top. True for any business, getting the job doesn't mean you're keeping the job. Winning the client doesn't mean he's staying forever. Most people seem to understand that. They get a big opportunity and usually realize they now have to go out and earn that salary, working even harder to prove they deserve it. But if you're an athlete who just got rich quick, the day you sign that contract can easily be the beginning of the end. You're already on the pedestal. Your shoe deal is in place. Now you're not just known by the team you play for, you're known by your brand affiliation. Instead of spending the summer working on your game, you're traveling the world pitching your sportswear. Your group of friends just grew 10 times larger than it was a week ago. And you're no longer dreaming about what you can do for the game, but what the game can do for you. You took what was handed to you, and that was the end. I'm using athletes as an example here, but you know it applies to anyone else as well. What have you been handed, and what are you willing to earn? At some point, you got a gift. Maybe you were blessed with a talent, or you inherited the family business, or someone took a chance on you and let you in the door. Then what? Doors swing two ways. Did you shut it on the competition or on yourself? There's nothing wrong with receiving a gift. That's where the challenge begins. Like a lot of people with a crazy dream, I saw an opportunity, worked hard to develop it, and never stopped working to see how far I could take it. Whenever other people in my business want to rip me, they say, "Sure, the guy started with Michael Jordan. It's not hard to train the best." If you think it's not hard to take the best and find ways to make him better, you've never had to face that challenge. It's easy to improve on mediocrity, not so easy to improve on excellence. Cleaner law. When you reduce your competition to whining that you got lucky, you know you're doing something right. There are no shortcuts, and there is no luck. People always say, "Good luck," in a pressure situation. No, it's not about luck. I don't believe in luck. There are facts and opportunities and realities, and how you respond to them determines whether you succeed or fail. Even the lottery isn't about luck. There's a set of numbers, either you get them right or you don't. When the game is on the line, you don't want to hear, "Good luck," It suggests you're not prepared. When you're headed to a job interview, you don't need luck. You need to know you're prepared and in control, and you're not relying on some random events or mystical intervention. Luck becomes a convenient excuse when things don't go your way, a rationale for staying comfortable while you wait for luck to determine your fate. You can't be relentless if you're willing to gamble everything on the unknown. It doesn't matter what you get handed. It's what you do after you receive it that affords you the privilege of saying, "I did this on my own." If you get that gift and decide you're all set, you stand no chance, zero, of ever understanding greatness or excellence. Now you're the opposite of unstoppable. You stopped all on your own. Dwayne is the perfect example of receiving nothing but talent and taking it to the top. From a small high school in Chicago, not known for its great basketball program, he was barely recruited by any colleges and ended up at Marquette. He didn't even play his freshman year because of academic reasons. But he knew what it was going to take if he had any chance of making it to the pros, and he fought his way back. In 2003, he was drafted by the Miami Heat, the fifth pick after LeBron James, Darko Milicic, Carmelo Anthony, and Chris Bosh. That's right. Of the big three, Dwayne Wade was the last one drafted. He arrived in Miami without billboards, mega-million-dollar shoe deals, or a crown. He just showed up and played. 3 years later, he had his first championship ring. It would be years before anyone drafted ahead of him would do the same. You cannot understand what it means to be relentless until you have struggled to possess something that's just out of your reach. Over and over, as soon as you touch it, it moves farther away. But something inside you, that killer instinct, makes you keep going, reaching, until you finally grab it and fight with all your might to keep holding on. Anyone can take what's sitting right in front of them. Only when you're truly relentless can you understand the determination to keep pursuing a target that never stops moving. No question, those who are gifted get to the top faster than anyone else. So what? Is that your excuse for not reaching as high? The challenge is staying there, and most people don't have the balls to put in the work. If you want to be elite, you have to earn it. Every day, everything you do. Earn it, prove it, sacrifice. No shortcuts. You can't fight the elephants until you've wrestled the pigs, messed around in the mud, handled the scrappy, dirty issues that clutter everyday life so you can be ready for the heavy stuff later. There's no way you can be prepared to compete and survive at anything if you start with the elephants. No matter how good your instincts are, you'll always lack the basic knowledge needed to build your arsenal of attack weapons. And when you're surrounded by those elephants, they'll know they're looking at a desperate newcomer. One summer I had about 50 guys in the gym, a combination of veterans and pre-draft players, including one young man who had never spent a single day wrestling a pig. He had gone to good schools with top coaches and came from a great family that made sure he had whatever he needed. He worked hard, but everything had been too easy, from scholarships to trophies, and he became a big star without paying a whole lot of dues. He expected to be drafted high and had no idea how things worked in the real world, unprotected by the college environment and supportive followers. He was a marked man from the minute he touched the ball. Every single player in the gym that day had one mission: fuck this kid up. Not nice, but competition rarely is. And because he had never been exposed to that level of heat and anger, he completely crumbled. He couldn't do a thing. Out of those 50 guys in the gym that day, he ranked 51st. And he learned the hard way that there's not a magazine cover or a parade that can help you when you're not prepared. People who start at the top never understand what they missed at the bottom. The guy who started by sorting the mail, or cleaning the restaurant late at night, or fixing the equipment at the gym. That's the guy who knows how things get done. After he's eventually worked his way up through the ranks, he knows how everything works, why it works, what to do when it stops working. That's the guy who will have longevity and value and impact, because he knows what it took to get to the top. You can't claim you ran a marathon if you started at the 17th mile. Most people are looking for an elevator instead of taking the stairs. They want the easy route. People quit their workouts and diets because they're too hard. They stop advancing in their careers and lives because it's too much work. Guys make it to the pros and then don't want to play for coaches who are too tough. They can't deal with being uncomfortable, so they seek the shortcut. And when they can't find it, they quit. For all of Michael's amazing moves and unforgettable moments, he knew none of that could happen without the fundamentals. Those basic moves he had practiced over and over and over since he was a kid made everything else possible. He didn't work on being flashy. He worked on being consistent, and he worked on it relentlessly. Cleaners don't care about instant gratification. They invest in the long-term payoff. Ask yourself, honestly, what would you have to sacrifice to have what you really want? Your social life? Relationships? Credit cards? Free time? Sleep? Now answer this question. What are you willing to sacrifice? If those two lists don't match up, you don't want it badly enough. No matter what you do, if you're in it for the money or the attention, if you're not willing to put in the hard work and the commitment, if you're okay with just being okay, I have to ask you, why? Look, it's enough for a lot of people. I'm not judging. They don't want the pressure and stress. They don't want to sacrifice time with friends and family. They want to party when the mood strikes, sleep late when they can, and get up and go to bed with limited worries and responsibilities and pressure. I get that. It's a much easier way to experience life. But usually, those are the same people who look around at others who have more success and say, "I can't believe how lucky that guy is. I could do that if..." Stop. You could do that if... what? If you put in more time and effort? If you commit to whatever is making it work for him? If you're willing to pay the price he's paying? What's he doing that you can't do? That's what I thought. You could do the same, and so much more. What's stopping you? And even if you can't do it his way, and why should you, why aren't you doing it your own way? Don't be jealous of someone if you had the same opportunity and you let it slip away. When did hard work become a skill? It doesn't take talent to work hard. Anyone can do it. Show up, work hard, and listen. It takes a willingness to be dedicated, to improve, to be better. I don't care if you're a superstar or the weakest guy on the team. Anyone can show up, work hard, and listen. Are you looking for that non-existent shortcut, or are you ready to do things the right way? Do you want it easy, or do you want it great? During the 2011-2012 NBA season, which started 2 months late due to a labor dispute, a lot of players suffered serious injuries. Almost all the blame was placed squarely on the lockout, the shortened season, too many games with too little rest. When the labor standoff ended and the league rushed into action with limited workouts and practice, everyone complained that the players had no time to get ready. The consequences were immediately obvious. Many players were out of shape, poorly conditioned, unprepared to play, and on their way to being injured, some for days or weeks, others for the entire season. But here's my question. Why were the players out of shape, poorly conditioned, and unprepared to play? Seriously, all those months, sitting around waiting for the lockout to end, what else did they have to do? When you use your body for a living, you have one job and it requires one thing. Work hard to stay in peak condition. That's it. Protect your body and your skills, get in shape, and stay that way. It's a year-round commitment, not a hobby. You're supposed to be the best in the world. You're one of only a few hundred athletes who get to have this job, and you can't work out because you don't know when the season is starting? Who the hell cares when the season is starting? Get your ass in the gym! Yet when it was clear that the NBA season would start late, or perhaps not at all, the majority of players trained less, or not at all, deciding they could put in the hard work when necessary. I heard it over and over. Didn't want to pay for trainers. Didn't want to waste the time and effort required to get to that level of preparedness. Great. Now we've got some of the greatest athletes on earth putting in the same effort as the average guy at the health club. Maybe less.
If we had known when the season was going to start...
Stop it. What difference did it make? You should have been ready to go, instead of planning to do the real work when the season was ready to roll. You can't prepare for the intensity of an entire NBA season at the last minute, especially one that would be condensed and allow little time for rest and recovery. Oh, you didn't know the schedule was going to be condensed? So what? You should still have been ready. One guy who took no shortcuts getting ready for the season was Kobe. Given his history of injuries and his long list of accomplishments, it would have been easy for him to take the summer off, get some rest, and wait for the league to settle its issues. Instead, he invested the time working out, training, and preparing to be better than ever. So when most players were relaxing with light workouts that did nothing to prepare them for the grueling months ahead, Kobe and I were in the gym most of the summer and fall, putting in hours every day, usually twice a day, and sometimes more. When the season finally started on Christmas Day, when other players were still trying to find their legs and their shot, he was already mentally and physically ready. In the months that followed, he played through A, knee pain, B, torn wrist ligaments, C, a broken nose, and D, a concussion. And he did not miss a single game until he was kicked in the shin playing against the Hornets in April, an injury that sidelined him for 7 games and forced him to take an unwanted rest that ultimately cost him the scoring title. Until that injury, he never asked to sit out, never took a shortcut. No one but Kobe can know the pain and discomfort he endured, but the hard work he had already put in paid off, and his body allowed him to keep going when most athletes would have had to sit. In anything you do, it takes no talent to work hard. You just have to want to do it. I could tell you so many stories about athletes blessed with incredible physical talent, size, power, pure athletic excellence, who end up playing sports only because that's where their gifts direct them. They don't love it, or even like it, but that's where they end up because they're so physically extraordinary. So they have no motivation to do more because they don't crave the end result. They're happy to be there if there's a parade at the end, but if there's not, they're okay with that too. You can tell those players, for the same money you can go to this team, but you'll probably sit on the bench, or you could go to this other team and play every day, but first they need you to drop 40 pounds and get in shape. And every time they'll say, I'm getting paid either way? Fuck it. I don't need to get in shape. I had a player who fit so well where he was, they loved him there. And when his contract was up, they offered him $42 million, which was probably $32 million more than he was worth. Then, another team offered him $48 million. Please, I said, stay where you are. You don't fit with the other team. They won't know how to use you. It's a mistake. Of course, he took the money and changed teams. And that extra $6 million has probably cost him at least $20 million because, surprise, it didn't work out. and he cheated himself out of what could have been a longer and more successful career. Spend your career on